Welcome to the To Love, Honor, and Vacuum podcast. I'm Sheila from the To Love, Honor, and Vacuum blog, where we like to talk about how to make marriage less of a to-do list and more of a passionate adventure. And today, I just have a string of consciousness, a bunch of different thoughts that I would like to share with you that I think, I'm hoping, are going to link up into a way that we can start thinking about loneliness and connection in a different way. And it's a missing piece that I've been finding in all the talk about the shooting sprees. And so I would like to take us on a little bit of a journey that hopefully is going to get somewhere with a destination. So let me jump in and say that I'm sad. I am actually sad today. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that on a personal level. As I'm recording this, it's Tuesday, August 6th, the day that would have been my son's 23rd birthday. And I was thinking, this is the birthday that no one celebrates. And that's just a weird place to be when you're missing someone that should be here. And yet at the same time, you feel grateful for the family that you do have. And so it's this very strange dynamic where I love the kids I have, but I still miss the one that I lost. So that got me down. And because it was his birthday and we had a long weekend in Canada, I took some time to myself this weekend and I ended up watching some movies that were depressing. I watched a movie of someone dying of cancer. Like, why do I do these things? And then the news of the shootings broke and yeah, I just kind of felt like the weight of the world was coming down on me. But as I was processing and talking to other people about these shootings and just reading some different things online, a whole bunch of things coalesced, and I would like to share those with you. And not all of these are profound, by the way. I just want to share with you some of my thinking processes, which is going to get us to where we're going. So here is Exhibit A. I watched the movie Otherhood on Netflix. It's not amazing. It's not something I would highly recommend or anything, but it passed the time while I was knitting, and we'll just leave it at that. But there was something interesting about the plot. Basically, it's about these three moms, and I'm going to say they're in their 50s maybe, and they have three sons. Each seems to just have one child. The sons were friends when they were children. They're now grown up and living in Manhattan. And it's Mother's Day, and all three boys forget to talk to their moms. And so these three moms decide to go and live at their sons' places, basically crash their sons' lives for a couple of days. And in so doing, what we find is that these guys, who are all probably early 30s, late 20s, are living their lives largely without the influence of family. And it's really not working for them. And so they need these moms to remind them that relationships are good things and that basic stuff like eating and sitting at a table and acting like a family, there's a reason that we do these things because we forget them. And when we leave home and when we're out on our own, we often forget all those domestic things and we think they really don't matter and we might think badly of our moms for them. And yet without those things, without that anchor of family, you miss out on so much. And these men all need their moms to help them take relationships more seriously and put more of an emphasis on thinking about the future. And it also shows the emptiness of sexual promiscuous lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I'm not saying it's an amazing movie. There's a lot of questionable things in it. But I thought that view of how empty so many people's lives are, and they don't even realize it because we don't emphasize relationships and marriage. Studies have shown that basically everybody still says they want to get married. Like, it's still upwards in the upper 80s. So that's almost everybody. But when people say that, what they're thinking is someday, like in my 30s. And so in your 20s, you just want to spend it doing whatever, living for you. But that's a very empty lifestyle. And it doesn't work out well for a lot of people. And I'm not sure we were supposed to have this decade where you just live for yourself. Well, actually, I'm quite sure that we're not supposed to have this empty decade where you just live for yourself. That is what our society has become. So that's Exhibit A. Exhibit B. England now has a minister of loneliness. Like, it's actually a cabinet position, okay? The minister of loneliness, because they have realized that loneliness is such a huge health issue. And loneliness, not just among the elderly, but among people in general, is causing some major social problems. And it's a major issue. And so they've now dedicated a whole cabinet position to loneliness. Isn't that interesting? Exhibit C. I've been watching a couple of other miniseries where people tend to emphasize their job over their marriage. And so they won't invest in a relationship if it's going to imperil their job. And I have never understood this line of thinking, but I see it in the media constantly. I hear people talking about it. Even my husband's a doctor, among residents who are currently in medical school. You know, they don't want to do anything that would hurt their career. And so the thought is, relationships are always going to be there later. I need to invest in my career now. That's a very backwards way of thinking about it. Because it's our relationships that are going to give us the most meaning and the most joy in our lives. And when we think of them as afterthoughts, as things that we can always tack on once we've accomplished the important things, I think it's far less likely we're going to get those relationships in the first place. Okay, Exhibit D. I read a really interesting article this week on the digital divide. They used to talk about the marriage divide, the marriage gap. And what they meant was that the marital status of your parents actually has a greater impact on your future life than does race, than does your social class, than does neighborhood, anything, educational status of parents, anything. Whether or not your parents are married is a bigger predictor of success in life than anything else. Like, it's bigger than race, okay? It is bigger than what social income group you are in. This really matters. So they've been talking about that for decades, but now what they're talking about is also a digital gap. And what they mean by that is that the lower classes tend to spend a lot more hours on screens than upper class kids do. And when you combine this marriage gap, because upper class people are far more likely to both get married and stay married than lower class, when you combine the marriage gap with the digital gap, we now have a lower class that has a much more difficult time raising out of that lower class. It used to be that everybody was married. It used to be that everybody would read books to their kids. Now that's just not true. And so the lower classes are growing up in an extremely different life than the upper classes. And this is solidifying the class divide. So, you know, 30 years ago, it was quite easy to move from one social class to another social class over the course of your life. Today, our classes are much more rigid. And it's largely because of these things that we go through as kids, these digital divides and these marriage gaps. And then there's Exhibit E. 22% of millennials say they have no friends. That's bigger than any other generation, and it's bigger than any generation has ever reported in past surveys. So 22% say they have no friends. So this is the most disconnected generation. So put all of these things together, right? This movie of these guys who don't know how to value relationships, the fact that we have a minister of loneliness, that 22% of millennials are lonely, that there's a digital gap where people are spending, especially the lower classes, all of their life on screens and not with people. Our media talks about how people should be choosing jobs over relationships. And maybe it's no wonder that we are growing up so disconnected from community, where we have no community. It's no wonder that such terrible things are happening. And I'm not trying to blame the shootings on this. I actually haven't read a lot of news about the shootings. And I'm Canadian. I am not going to talk about gun control. I do not want to talk about American politics or about political rhetoric or any of the stuff that's been talked about. I don't even want to touch mental illness for a minute. But I do think that this idea that we are more and more disconnected from each other and that more and more young people are growing up so lonely matters. And so I'm going to bring Rebecca onto this podcast, and I want to talk about specific things that we can do to help the next generation not be so disconnected and not be so lonely.
Some parents say all teenagers go off the rails. Teenage rebellion is inevitable. Or is it? I say it's not. I'm Rebecca Gregoire-Lindenbach, and I never rebelled. I spent 5 months talking to millennials, hearing their stories, to discover why they didn't rebel either. And the answers weren't what I was expecting. Check out my book, Why I Didn't Rebel, to find out why your kids don't need to either.
Okay, Becca, so what can we do to help people feel less disconnected? Let's talk about that.
Okay, let's talk about it.
So number one, and this is something which I have talked about in the blog ad nauseum, and one of the big things Daddy talks about, because I can't say Daddy on the podcast. I don't even know what, you're 24 years old and I still refer to your father to you as Daddy. But anyway, this is one of the things that Keith talks about all the time with his patients. Have dinner together.
Yeah.
Like, just, it really is important to do family life together.
It is, and I think that it's because it forces kids to kind of leave their own little world for a bit and enter into a world where there are other people.
Yeah, and you know, doing dinner together, sometimes it needs to have a purpose. Like, I remember a commenter, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, saying that she tries to do dinner together, but everybody just ends up bickering and it just doesn't work because so-and-so doesn't like his food and then so-and-so tries to hit his sister. And I'm not talking about just sitting at the table. The point of having dinner together is also that you talk.
Yes. And I think also, though, like if you're having dinner together and one kid isn't eating their food and one kid won't stop hitting his sister, well, then you've got some things that you need to work on as a family, right? Like, if you aren't having dinner together, would you never notice that one kid is super picky in the same way? Or would you not really tackle the issue, the fact that the kid's hitting his sister? You know, if all the kids are so used to playing separately or playing in a different room, you might not even recognize some of these things are happening.
Yeah, so you got to get your kids together. But also, I think a lot of the times that kids act out is because they're bored.
Yeah.
And kids can get bored. I mean, sitting at a table and just eating can be boring. And that's why when I say have dinner together, I don't just mean all sit down and eat. I mean, sit down, but then have some planned conversations. Like, go around the table and everybody talk about your high and low of the day. And everyone has to listen to each other.
We used to have those dumb Canadian trivia cards that we went through.
Yeah, we had great Canadian. And Matthew, yes. Your cousin, no matter what the question was, always answered Charlottetown.
Yes, that's exactly right.
In what city was Confederation planned? Charlottetown. And he actually got that one right. He was so excited. But yes, yeah, we had trivia games. We had a lot of stuff for when we had dinner together, but it made family dinner fun, and people actually liked coming over to our house and experiencing our dinner time.
Yeah, because often when you have family dinners, what it ends up being is all the kids need to be quiet, sit down and shut up, kids, so that mom and dad can reconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one of them's just gotten back from a long day at work, and then you had to go straight to, you know, mowing the lawn, making dinner, and now this is your first chance to really sit down as a couple as well. But when that happens, kids just kind of feel like they're forced into this awkward, boring sit-down thing with food where, let's be honest, most grown-up dinner foods are not kids' favorites.
That's right.
You know, like, it's like another slow cooker chicken meal that mom and dad think is awesome, and the kids are like, why on earth would you not make chicken as chicken fingers?
Right, and why is the sauce on everything, and why is my chicken touching my potatoes?
Exactly, the travesty. And so, When it's not about the kids at all, I think that's often where a lot of these problems come into.
Yeah, it's not really fair to the kids either. Like, talk to your kids. So when you're all sitting at the table, do stuff that involves everyone. Whether it's asking stupid trivia questions or doing your high and low of the day or whatever. But then people learn how to have a conversation, how to listen to each other, how to respond to one another. It's actually quite important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, number two, when your kids are smaller, be social with other families so that your kids learn how to interact with other kids.
Yeah, I think this is especially important if you have a single child, like an only child.
Mm-hmm.
And also just with the nature of siblings too, you're often much different ages. And so if you have some kids there who are the same age as your kid, that's also an important thing to understand.
Mm-hmm. You know, starting when you were 5 and Katie was 2, we went camping every year until you were probably 16 or 17 with the same family.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that had two boys. That were, Liam was a year and a half younger than you, so a year older than Katie, and Paul was 6 months younger than Katie, so 4 of you, two boys, 2 girls, basically the same age, and you grew up with them.
Yes, we did.
And they were great friends. They still are.
Yeah.
They still come over to the house on New Year's, and yeah, they were at all your weddings and helped out at your weddings, and yeah, like, great. But, you know, we got to know that family from the time you were really little. And it's not like you always got along either.
No, we have so many home videos of me and Liam just bossing around Katie and Paul. Or, like, I remember me and Paul would get so angry at Liam and Katie because they always ganged up together on board games. And Paul would, of course, not actually want to gang up with me because that would be the logical thing to do. Instead, he would just go and try to go out in a blaze of glory. And I got so angry because it was impossible to actually win anything. Like, we had our fights. We had our bickers. Because when you're with someone for that long, it really does become more like a community kind of family situation than it is just like, oh, we're having this nice family over for 2 hours once every 2 months.
Yeah, you can't. Right? You're together for 2 weeks with mosquitoes and the extreme heat, and you get, yeah. you get to really know each other. But then you have to work things out.
Exactly, and that was a skill that all of us had to learn, and we got better at it as we got older. I mean, then we got worse at it, and we hit puberty, but then we got better at it again.
Yeah, and we used to do that a lot, and the reason that I had people over was not just because I wanted you guys to have other kids to play with, but also just because I didn't want to be bored. I always found it was easier to handle you guys when there were other friends for you to play with, so I would often invite other couples over with kids just so that, like, your father, I almost said daddy and I, your father and I, you know, would have that really fun couple time with other couples because you guys could be playing. And so I just think that social time is so important with your children.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know, some kids are just naturally introverted. They're naturally shy. And if they can learn how to get along with kids in a safer environment, it's going to be easier for them when they're in school.
Yes.
And I think that can diminish the power of bullies too, because if they know that there are other kids who like them, even if those kids aren't in their class at school, the bullies lose some of their effect as well. Some mm-hmm. of their power, really.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of going along with number two, the third point we really want to talk about is the need for unstructured social time. Because I think a lot of parents look at their kids and they see, well, he's in soccer on Tuesdays and they're in swimming lessons on Wednesdays and he's got hockey on Thursdays and then we're away for some sort of tournament every weekend. And so he's got lots of time with friends. But that's not the same thing as unstructured friend time.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have unstructured time, that's when you start doing, like, the imaginative play. And that's when you start making up new games. And that's when you start, you know, having to be creative because you're just bored together, right?
Right.
When I was growing up, we lived in this little cul-de-sac kind of crescent neighborhood that just happened to have a ton of families with kids all within kind of 4 years of each other. So it was really great. And pretty much every day after school, someone would go around knocking on everyone's door saying, hey, do you want to go play cops and robbers at the end of the street? Or, you know, do you want to come over and we can play dinosaurs? Or there was always something going on. But the thing that made that possible was that the majority of the kids in the neighborhood were only outside the house, like, maximum 2 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
So it was so easy to find someone to play with because we all kind of had this family culture of just being around. Right? I knew I could go and knock on Nick and Chris's door, and odds are they would be there unless it was Thursday night. Right? And so we all just got to get to know each other so well, and we all just played together all of the time because we had that unstructured time that was available to be social. And it is so different than when you're all doing these really planned out, structured activities because you don't actually learn how to be socially creative in those kinds of situations. You may learn manners and rules and how to be polite and how to get people to like you, sure, but that's very different than, like, I'm bored, do you want to go play, and then figure out something to do so you're not bored anymore.
Right, because that's what's missing, I think, from people in their
20s. I think so, too.
Is we don't know how to take initiative. When you're bored, maybe what I should be doing is finding someone to do something.
Yeah, or looking.
That's not people's default setting, whereas it should be. It should be, and it is, and if your kids don't know how to do that, when I'm bored, I should find someone to spend some time with, it's very unlikely they're going to do it mm-hmm. in their 20s.
And obviously, we had it easy because our neighborhood just happened to be really, really good. But you can kind of help create that for your kids, too, you know, by having, like, a group of kids from church or from school or from, you know, other areas in your community that kind of you are your go-tos for who to call.
Mm-hmm. And let me just put a big plug in here too. You know what? I grew up in a big city and I got out as soon as I could. Best thing I ever did. It's so much cheaper. So much cheaper if you do not have to live in a big city. Get out. Okay. That has nothing to do with the
except
podcast.
Except that loneliness that's indexes are something. Much higher in big cities than they are in small towns.
There you go. So maybe it doesn't do the podcast, but that could be number 3.5. Wasn't going to mention
exactly.
It.
There you go. A little bonus.
Go live in a small town if you can. It is a lot better. Okay. Number 4, huge important one, is just to rethink screen time. Keith and I were talking about this recently. He brings this up all the time in his office when he deals with behavior problems and with school problems and with ADD and all of these issues, is screen time has a huge negative effect on kids. And, you know, there's a difference to talk about teenagers and talking about small children. There is no reason for a 1 or 2 or 3 year old to be on screens for a long period of time. I'm not saying you have to be completely screen free, okay? Although he does have more and more families apparently are going completely screen free. Like, he sees more of them now than he did 5 years ago. So I think people are waking up to this. But you really shouldn't have your very small children on screens. I mean, what did they say in psych about that?
Oh, like, my goodness.
You did a lot of this in your
degree.
They have
a lot to say about that. Pretty much every professor I've ever had has said that if you're giving your kid your cell phone or an iPad, you're pretty much altering their cognitive development a little bit. Like, you're making it more difficult for them to learn the things they need to learn. And that boredom is one of the best things you can give your kids. And the problem with these, like, iPad games or even, like, the Leapfrog pads, like the iPad for kids and stuff like that, is that they're so immediately gratifying and they require no creative thought. Like, zero creative thought. You literally click a screen and it flashes something pretty. You know, or you watch a YouTube video and it's like 2 inches from your face versus it being on a TV, which is, you know, 5 feet away from the child or 7 feet away from the child, which is much, much better for their brain. Still not like, I mean, like 8 hours of TV a day also is not good. But like the idea of like, even if you want your kids to watch a show while you make dinner, which is what we often did when we were little, you know?
Yeah, we weren't totally screen free. I use screens when it was necessary for my
exactly.
sanity.
Exactly. But it's so much better to do that on a TV where the kids are sitting on the floor like 10 feet, like 5 to 10 feet away.
You never sat on. But actually, that's the point, is that you weren't sitting on the floor. Katie normally was upside down on a couch, which is important.
Yes.
Like, to move. Yes, she would be moving.
Yes. No, but the idea is that a lot of times when we give kids these screens, they get so involved in this small little world of instant gratification that it actually takes away from their ability to do imaginative play, from their ability to self kind of entertain, and also their attention span gets down to, like, nothing.
Right. Okay. Here, this is your intellectual moment on the podcast where we're going to get really intellectual for a minute. But a wonderful Canadian, his name was Marshall McLuhan, and he was a sociologist in the 1950s or 60s. I should know this. I have a master's in sociology, but now I forget. I'm also Canadian, but there you go. Anyway, he said something brilliant, which was that the medium is the message. And what he meant by that is that part of the message that we hear is determined by the medium on which we hear it. So for instance, news, when you're reading it from a newspaper, is very different from news when you're watching it on TV. Because when TV took over news, sound bites became a thing. Because it had to be exciting. So everything had to be condensed to a sentence. And if we're trying to condense massive policies into one sentence, then we're going to start dumbing everything down. Right? So that's what he meant by the medium is the message. There's also a big difference between watching a movie and reading a book, because when you're reading a book, you're actually creating the story in your head. You have to imagine and picture what's going on. And so you become part of the story. Whereas when you're watching it on a television screen, it's all done for you. So it's very passive. Reading is actually an active medium, whereas watching is a passive one. So all that being said, we need to remember that if the medium is the message, what message are we starting to give kids, or are kids starting to believe when they're spending their lives on screens? It's that everything has to be entertaining, that my life is very small and my life is all that matters because all I see is what's right in front of me, just what you just said. So if we want our kids to think bigger, We need to get away from screens. And here's something radical. Start reading books again. Books are awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, how did your life change when you started reading?
I don't remember, because we always read.
But I remember when you started, when you could read a book by yourself, my life changed. Because I have a great picture. I'll even put it in the description to this podcast, in the blog post that goes along with this podcast. We were in England, and you were 7.5 years old, and we were in Canterbury. And we were sitting down by the river where we were watching the punting boats, and you pulled out a book, and you just sat there to read. It was the most perfect thing. It brought tears to my eyes how perfect it was. But we always had books with us wherever we went, and you loved to
read. And the reason, and this might sound kind of weird, that we're saying if you want your kids to be more social, teach them how to do solitary activities like reading. Like, that might not seem like it makes a lot of sense. But here's the thing. What your kids learn in terms of their own personal development skills, like their attention span, their ability to imagine, their ability to be creative, the level of self-centeredness as well, that they take on, or the need for instant gratification, those actually are also social skills. And when your kid is then in a social setting, if they're used to being creative and being imaginative, which are things that you get more from books and reading than you would from being in front of an iPad with again, it's instant gratification, those are the kinds of kids who are more pleasant for other children to be around. Because they're more interesting. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who think of the reason people actually liked hanging out with me and my sister was because we thought of really, really fun games. We did, okay? That was one of the things we did really well. We thought of really fun games. We didn't have a single friend I can't think of between the ages of like 5 and like 10 where like their games were, like, they used to come over to our house and ask us what we were playing, kind of thing. They didn't used to come and say, hey, let's play this. They'd be like, hey, what are we doing today? And they'd be all excited. They're like, oh, well, today we're going to be, you know, fur trappers, and we're going to play this, because we were really Canadian. But the thing is, and this is going to sound a little bit harsh, but a lot of kids who have a hard time making friends, it's not always because the other kids are mean. Sometimes it's because that child is just a little bit difficult to be friends with when you're also a young child. You know, like if you're a 7-year-old who's trying to make friends, you're going to gravitate towards the friends who are, you know, interesting and patient and who have social skills. And so the best thing you can do for your kid is to give them those social skills by not kind of putting them towards a lot of these things that are going to hurt them in those areas.
Okay, this is intellectual bit number 2 that we're going to insert into this podcast, which is how books create moral development. Because here's the interesting thing to go along with the medium is the message, is that because the child, when they're reading, they have to create the story in their mind. So they have to picture it in their mind. And because of that, emotionally, because they've actually created the story in their mind, they actually experience much more of what that character goes through than you do if you just watch the same thing on a movie. And so if a character in a book has overcome some major trial by making some major character discovery, sort of like Edmund, let's take Edmund in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, how Edmund learns how being selfish and lying actually hurts other people, and so he learns how to be selfless. As you're reading, you actually make that same moral discovery because you're taking part in creating that story in your imagination. So they find that reading books is highly related to a child's moral development. And so the more interesting books you can read, the more varied books kids can read, the more moral discovery they actually make. And it is kind of cool how much kids can learn just by reading. Mm-hmm. And you guys, yeah, you had so many books. Like, Katie has reread Rilla of Ingleside. That's still her favorite in the Anne of Green Gables series, Rilla of Ingleside. I don't know. I think she rereads that every year. You know, all the Jane Austen. You guys read everything when you were little.
We really did.
And it's just such a great activity that I think we've forgotten. And if kids don't have screens, then they need to do one of two things. They either need to play with someone or they need to read a book. And both of those things are really good for kids.
They really are. And it's really good for sibling relationships, too. Not just friendships, either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so number 5, I think we're on number 5, is, and this is one that we were just talking about, is to rethink how church does social relationships. And this is a harder one because you can't influence this yourself in the same way because you can't necessarily change your church. But I just want to urge churches as a whole, you know, to rethink how we do social relationships.
Yeah, we've been talking about kids so far, but this really is actually talking about like current millennials.
Mm-hmm.
This one yeah. really is about current millennials. So I was actually, the reason this is coming up is I was actually having coffee with two of my friends back on Saturday, and we were talking about how the church just isn't set up for our generation to actually get to know people. And a lot of the reason for that is that, you know, especially right now I live in Ottawa, right? So I live in a big city area where we have some people who live out in the far east end, some people in the far west end, some people in the far south, and our church is kind of central for the most part. But then how do you actually get to know someone at a church, right? We all think Sunday morning, but are you really going to get to know anyone Sunday morning? Probably not. And if you volunteer, that's a really good way. But sometimes you volunteer and you become a Sunday school teacher and you only ever meet one other person, your Sunday school partner.
And a right? whole lot of grade fives.
And a whole lot of grade fives, exactly. And you can only talk about grade five stuff for so long until you go a little insane. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, the best way, honestly, to get into community is to join some sort of small group. But what do you have to do to join a small group these days? Well, you have to figure out, are you going to go to the one that's for your demographic but might be on the other side of town? Or do you go to one in your neighborhood might have some people who you don't really connect with or you don't really know and it's a little awkward? And then no matter what, you're showing up at someone's house who you might not have ever met before because you're going to try to meet people, which is incredibly uncomfortable, especially if you're like a single person who's going, not mm-hmm. as a couple. Because if you're a single dude, you're worried you're going to show up at a single girl's house and be like, ah, this is awkward. What do I do? Is this appropriate? Is this not? And if you're a single woman, you're like, well, is this like, am I going to be the only one there with like three dudes? Or like, it's just weird.
Well, and then there's the bit that no one ever talks about, which is animal allergies. Our family has so many animal allergies. We could never go to people's houses that had cats.
Yeah, I actually have talked about that. There was a small group we were going to join, and the lady who runs it is super sweet and has three cats. And I'm like, well, I can't go.
Yeah.
I just can't go. And so I guess what I want to ask churches is, why don't we just get back to having the church be the central hub of what happens, what's happening? You know, like, I know that there's a lot of logistical issues, but I really think it would be so much easier if the small groups kind of met at the church or something for the most part. Or where if you were in the neighborhood, you knew that the church, every night from 6 until 9, something was going on and you could just drop in.
Even, can't churches do more board game nights or something?
Yeah, like have a crafting night on Fridays for people. Just bring a hobby and just sit. And knit or cross stitch or something mm-hmm. like that. And then like on Tuesdays, yeah, host a family board games night where literally it's just like you sit there and you can just play games and you can just have fun and you can show up with friends. You can show up on your own, whatever it is. But I think that these kinds of home-based things like small groups are incredibly uncomfortable for a lot of people. Like I am not comfortable going to someone's house that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I am simply not. And I'm really plugged into my church. And on top of that, you know, even just the silly little things that no one really thinks about, but in order to want to host a small group, you're guaranteeing that your house will be clean every Tuesday at 7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're putting in all of that work, whereas we could just go to the church that gets cleaned anyway. Like, we're already doing it a lot of the time. But I just think this is one of those things that needs to be thought about, where it's like, what barriers are there to entry? Because right now, if you're a newcomer going to a church, you know, there's no real way to get involved in community in an easy way if you're not super comfortable showing up at a complete stranger's house.
Right.
Especially,
and that's an issue.
Well, and then I was saying to my friend too that I will not host a small group when we have a baby because I simply don't want people I don't know showing up at my house when I have a child.
Mm-hmm.
I simply don't. I'm sorry. Like, I know that that doesn't sound hospitable, but I have no problem with people who've been previously vetted coming over to my house.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something very different about today's culture where we have to be much more wary of these things. You know? And it's just,
It's these kinds of things are not often thought about, I think, when we talk about small groups and community. How great would it be if we all just show up at each other's houses and, like, yes, that would be great if people didn't have allergies and we all had stay-at-home housewives who could take care of all of our work for us and didn't have to also take care of the kids and could just keep the house clean and not embarrassing for people to just show up out of the blue. And if we all lived within a 10-minute radius like we used to when all these churches are small community plans. But that's not how it is anymore. And I think that you can go to a church and be very isolated because there's simply not an easy way to get involved in community. Whereas if we just made the church the central hub again, I think it would be really easy.
That would go a long way. All right, and here's our last bit to help millennials to raise kids who become millennials who aren't as disconnected, which is talk up marriage. And we already did this in another podcast about a month ago, I think. We were talking about how some parents of young adults are making it more difficult for those young adults to get married because they're saying, don't you date yet. You concentrate on school and you concentrate on getting a good job and don't let any person derail that. When I would just say, talk up marriage. And not to say to your child that they have to get married or that there's something wrong with them if they're single, but just talk up relationships. And let them know that their life is not just defined by what they do as a career, but that friends and potential spouses and all those people, that's what ends up really mattering.
Exactly, because then if you have a kid who's in their mid-20s and who's killing themselves over a career they don't even really enjoy, just so that they can kind of make enough money, quote-unquote, or they can feel like they've done enough, like, in terms of their productivity, like, that's not going to help with the loneliness issue, necessarily. And so I think giving kids permission to not be extraordinary in every single area because they want to focus on creating a great community around them, whether or not they even get married.
Yep.
Right? Yep. I think that can be such a huge gift to your kids, especially with the amount of, like, performance anxiety and the like that's going around in my generation, because there is so much of this hustle hard mentality and friendships are being left in the distance. And so giving your kids permission to prioritize people, even if it means that they're less productive than they could be.
Because that's what Jesus did. And I don't mean to be trite. I mean that honestly, that is what Jesus did. He prioritized people, and we are raising our kids to prioritize other things. And then we get surprised when they feel disconnected or when 22% of them report that they're lonely. So let's rethink how we raise kids. Let's rethink how we talk up relationships. And maybe, hopefully, the next generation will not be nearly as disconnected as the millennials are.
Every week on the podcast, I like to highlight a comment that's come in either on the blog or social media. And today's kind of a standalone one from a guy who writes in on the blog. And he says, my wife and I have been married for over 20 years and the sex has been just okay. There have been dry spells for sure, but we're getting better as we go. This much I know, she has never had an orgasm, nor does she want to. I have expressed to her my desire for her to experience orgasm and my desire to help her get there, but it's met with disinterest on her part. Every time I suggest it or try to move into position with my hands or whatever, she pulls me and my hands away and says she just wants the intercourse. It's very discouraging because I think it would only draw us closer and allow for more intimacy. It would open up a whole new world for us. I just can't wrap my head around someone not being open to the idea of their spouse giving them pleasure. You know, I read this and I think this is really, really very typical and also what can be expected when we are raising women and girls in our churches where the message that they're getting all the time is that men need sex and women need to give it to them. And we hear about how men lust and how men can't help themselves and how we have to have sex or else men are going to have affairs or watch porn and all of these messages that are so harmful. And I've talked about this ad nauseum on the blog, but one of the big effects is that women grow up thinking they don't have a sex drive. And they grow up thinking, as long as I let my husband have intercourse with me, I am doing my wifely duty. And that's what really matters. And so I'm reading this comment and I'm thinking his wife could very well be very proud of herself for how much she is letting her husband have sex. And that often is how we women think about it. You know, I'm letting my husband do this. Aren't I doing a good thing?
And it's as if our experience is completely beside the point. It doesn't even register. And this woman has lost touch with the fact that she has any sexuality whatsoever. Now, there may be other things going on in the marriage, but, you know, from his comment, it doesn't sound like it. But even if in this particular couple's case, there's something else going on in the marriage, I have heard the same kind of thing from many, many couples. And this idea is very prevalent that women feel like we just need to give our husband sex, which means, and I'm going to be very, very blunt here, so excuse me for this, but he puts his penis into her vagina until he climaxes. That is how we think of sex. And the woman's experience doesn't enter into that at all. This is why I'm so adamant that we need to change the definition of sex so that we understand that it is mutual. It needs to be talked about like that, that it was created for her too, that she is not just an object for him to lust after or an object to satisfy his lust so that he doesn't go elsewhere, but that this is something which was for her as well. And until we change that conversation, I don't think there's any wonder that so many women don't even consider themselves missing out on anything, because we don't understand there is anything for us to miss out on. If that's you, if you've never had an orgasm and you don't even see what the big deal is, I just want to assure you that there is something really huge that you're missing. And if your husband is willing to try that with you, please don't turn him down. Do the 31 Days to Great Sex together. It's a really easy exercise. It builds little by little in how to make sex better. It's only $4.99 in the ebook version, and it could really change your marriage. So, you know, try that, but don't give up, because you really were made for so much more.
31 Days to Great Sex. It's 31 really fun challenges in 31 days. Just read 2 to 4 pages a day together and do what it says. It's easy peasy. And don't worry, you don't have to have sex for 31 days straight. Instead, you'll learn to talk more openly about issues, flirt more, deal with baggage, figure out what feels good, try new things, spice things up, and so much more. It's the best 31 days you will ever have in your marriage. Why not start today?
On this podcast, I also like to highlight a reader question that's come in. And this one is really more of a comment or a piece of advice that came in from a reader, but I think it's important. We've been talking a lot on the blog in the last week or so about how you are not to blame if your spouse has an affair, and how getting over that affair and rebuilding, how you can't do that until the spouse who has had the affair accepts responsibility for what they did, confesses, and repents. You can't just say, well, I am going to forgive and we are going to rebuild, if the spouse does not understand the severity of how they broke the covenant. It really does matter. And then in the midst of all that, this comment came in, and it made me really sad. And I think it speaks to a lot of what this podcast is about. She says, "My husband had an emotional affair, and it has been one of the most gut-wrenching, painful seasons in my life. I remember the moment he drove up in the driveway and I was waiting for him in order to confront him. His work had just called wanting to talk to him, and when I said he wasn't home yet, they were surprised because he had left hours ago. I knew in my gut that he was spending time with another woman. When I confronted him, he admitted it, and I was broken in two. Our story has been a messy one, but we are still together. He had to change jobs as he couldn't completely break it off. We are still building a bridge of trust between us, and I wonder if that pain will ever go away. We are both Jesus-loving followers, and that is the only way we have been able to survive. I guess for me, I just want others to know that those flirtations are not harmless, and they can so easily entangle. It has made me aware of how I speak to other men. Please let your readers know it is dangerous territory, and to stand firm and renew that mind. It's been devastating to us." There's so much pain in the world, and maybe I'm feeling it more today because, like I said, I'm just sad. But there is a lot of pain in this world, and it really does hurt me to hear people's stories like this where the pain was so preventable. And so I just want to encourage all of you. It is really easy to give into a life where we don't try, where it's just all about entertainment and making sure that we have fun. That is a really easy life. That's why we're so addicted to our screens. That's why we don't have good relationships, because relationships are messy. But you know what? Without investing in these relationships, we end up with a lot of pain. And this woman is talking about pain because her husband wasn't careful. Her husband did not invest in the marriage, and now they're both reaping the consequences of that. And all of these millennials are lonely because they don't understand how important relationships are, and they didn't grow up with the tools for how to build those relationships. Entertainment is easy and people are hard. But you know what? Without those relationships, life can be very painful and very lonely. So please invest in each other. Let's make sure that what really matters is where our priorities lie. People matter to Jesus, and God made us for community. So let's never, ever forget that. And let's build our community too. Thank you for listening to the Love, Honor, Vacuum podcast. I ask all of you to subscribe. Please rate this on iTunes or wherever you listen to it. Give it a 5-star because that really does help more people want to listen to it as well. And so that can spread the word as we continue to fight back against Christian Pat Answers and for answers which really help us in the messiness of life. So join me on to lovehonorandvacuum.com as well. I blog there every day. There's lots of extra material from this podcast as well to see. And until then, I will see you again next week.